Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
And now, a next level moment from AT&T Business. Say you've sent out a gigantic shipment of pillows, and they need to be there in time for International Sleep Day. You've got AT&T 5G, so you're fully confident. But the vendor isn't responding, and International Sleep Day is tomorrow. Luckily, AT&T 5G lets you deal with any issues with ease, so the pillows will get delivered and everyone can sleep soundly, especially you. AT&T 5G requires a compatible plan and device. Coverage not available everywhere. Learn more at att.com/5G network.
Take the whole summer off without paying. Hi, I'm Jesuan Martinez, General Manager. Now at Rick Case, buy any new Hyundai like a new 25 Santa Fe, all with America's best warranty. 10 years, 100,000 miles, and owner assurance. And pay nothing at all till fall. That's no money down and no payments until September with approved credit. Plus, get in and out of the dealership in an hour or less, guaranteed. Rick Case is the place. Pay nothing at all till fall at Rick Case Hyundai on Weston Road or at RickCaseHyundaiDaily.com.
Hey, it's Kevin Hart. In this basketball season, Chase Freedom Unlimited is helping me cash back all my game tickets. Plus, tickets for 23 of my biggest fans to cheer me on while I enjoy the game.
Find your seats.
I appreciate the support, people.
Eat that pretzel.
This'll never get old.
Use more napkins.
Okay, this is starting to get old.
Say the tagline.
Cash back like a pro with Chase Freedom Unlimited. Chase, make more of what's yours.
Restrictions and limitations apply. Cards are issued by JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC.
Welcome to the Serial Killer Podcast, the podcast dedicated to serial killers. Who they were, what they did, and how. Episode 249. I am your humble host, Thomas Roseland Vyborg Thun. Last episode, I introduced you to the enigmatic professor, the loner, who initially refused to engage in any kind of politics, and was solely concerned with mathematics. Tonight, we continue to follow this young man as he disappears from society and builds what is probably America's most famous cottage. Enjoy. This episode, like all other sagas told by me, would not be possible without my loyal Patreonies. They are Lisbeth, Lisa, Kathy, Corbin, Meow, Val, Madeline, Craig, the Duggletons, Jonathan, Cheryl, Brad, Manuel, Ayulin, and Rachel. You are truly the backbone of the Serial Killer Podcast, and without you, there would be no show. Patreon is updated with more ad-free episodes for my TSK Producers Club, and I also have a bonus episode I am quite happy with for my $10 Plus Club members. Very soon I plan to publish yet another film review, and I do believe you will enjoy it. So don't miss out, and head on over to patreon.com/theserialkillerpodcast now. A solitary figure crested a mist-veiled ridge, his lean silhouette etched against the dawn's pale shimmer. He paused, his gaze sweeping over the vast forest sprawled below, a timeless expanse of ancient trees, their dense canopies weaving a shadow tapestry across the earth. His reddish hair, kissed by the sun's rays, stirred in the breeze, and his clean-shaven jaw set with quiet resolve as he drank in the wilderness's serene grandeur.
With a deft tug to secure his pack, he descended into a tranquil glade cradled by crystalline streams, its waters sparkling like polished silver. Here, in this untouched haven, he would establish his camp, enveloped by a profound silence broken only by the stream's gentle murmur and the soft rustle of treetops swaying in the wind. The forest was a living cathedral, its floor blanketed with masses of radiant green, glowing as if lit from within. Frigid ice-blue waters threaded through the landscape, fed by rains that dripped from overhanging branches, pooling among fallen trunks and scattered logs. The air carried the rich scent of damp earth, pine, and the faint tang of decay, a reminder of nature's ceaseless cycle. In this sacred stillness, the man, known to some as the Professor, kindled a fire from an assortment of woods, each type lending a distinct note to the curling smoke. The aroma wove into his clothes, tangled in his hair, and seeped into his thoughts, igniting a slow burning rage deep within his chest. Alone in the wilderness, he had time, far too much time, to dwell on the wounds of the past, both real and imagined. Each crackle of the fire seemed to echo his growing discontent, a smoldering ember of resentment fed by memories of a world he could no longer tolerate. As twilight descended, a distant howl pierced the silence, perhaps a wolf, though such creatures were now phantoms in these lands, driven to the edge of extinction by humanity's relentless advance. The professor's thoughts turned to the forces reshaping the earth. The Santa Barbara oil spill of 1969, a catastrophic blowout at Platform A, had stained the Pacific's waters while he was still a student at Berkeley, its images searing into his mind like a brand. Now, in 1970, Boeing aircraft dominated the news, having secured a government contract in May to develop a supersonic commercial jet over the next 7 years, a technological triumph that enraged the nascent environmental movement. To them, it was yet another sacrifice of nature on the altar of progress, a betrayal of the Earth's sanctity. The professor's eyes roamed the timberland, still lush and vibrant near his camp, but he knew it was a fleeting refuge. Since World War II, clear-cutting had scarred the national forests, with nearly 60% of logging operations in 1970 reducing verdant woodlands to desolate fields of stumps. The sight of these open wounds, stripped bare of life, fueled his anger, a righteous fury against a world that devoured what he held sacred. This man, once a scholar of promise, had vanished from the world's grasp. The Harvard Directory of 1969 to 1971 listed him at an obscure address, number 788, Banshat Pesh, Kadar Keb, Afghanistan. But his passport bore no trace of such a journey. In 1970, he paid no taxes, left no photographs, and severed all ties, becoming a specter adrift in the wild. His only tether was his brother, with whom he maintained sporadic contact, a faint thread connecting him to a life he had forsaken. These lost years were not spent in distant lands, but in a restless pilgrimage through America's woodlands, moving from shadowed glades to secluded mountain ledges, each step a rejection of the society he despised. After resigning from his academic post, the professor had driven to Wyoming to meet his brother, and together they ventured to British Columbia, seeking land to claim as their own. Near Prince George, he found a parcel that spoke to his soul, a rugged plot nestled in the embrace of ancient forests, where the air was sharp with the scent of pine and the earth pulsed with life. He filed homesteading applications, his heart set on a life unbound by civilization's chains. That summer of 1969, while awaiting word on his claim, he returned to the family home in Illinois, a place that felt increasingly foreign. He haunted the local library, poring over tomes of philosophy, history, and science, or wandered the nearby woods, their familiar paths offering solace. To sustain himself, he worked as a gardener at a nearby mall, his hands buried in the soil, grounding him in a world that still felt pure. But winter brought a crushing blow, a curt letter from Canada denying his homesteading request. For days he secluded himself in his room, the walls closing in as he scribbled letters to magazine editors, his pen a weapon against the forces he blamed for society's decay. On the 28th of February, 1970, he penned a letter to the editor of the Saturday Review, a manifesto of his burgeoning philosophy. I quote, C.W. Griffin Jr. exaggerates the extent to which Americans romanticize the freedom, independence, and adventure of the frontier. In any case, such romanticism should be regarded as a symptom rather than a disease. A happily married man does not daydream about romantic love. Similarly, a man does not romanticize frontier freedom unless he is suffering from a lack of personal autonomy. Mr. Griffin apparently would like to change people to make them fit the restrictive structure of society. Perhaps the better solution would be to change the structure of society, so that it becomes possible to allow some of the freedom and independence they seem to crave. A society, after all, is supposed to be designed for the benefit of the people that live in it, not the other way around. Griffin would put the blame for our environmental problems on excessive individual freedoms. Actually, most of the problems are direct or indirect results of the activities of large organizations, namely corporations and governments. It is these organizations, after all, that control the structure and development of society. Perhaps the most unfortunate thing that has happened to individual liberty was its being used as an excuse for the misdeeds of huge corporations. Now, the evils perpetrated by these highly collectivist organizations are blamed on individual liberty. End quote. By August, the professor had drifted to his brother's apartment in Great Falls, Montana, where he spoke of a rift with their parents. A month earlier, his brother had received a note from them quoting a letter the professor had sent. In it, he called them the best parents anyone could have, expressing regret if he had disappointed them. He urged them not to worry, insisting he needed to forge his own path. In a moment of tentative reconciliation, he proposed a venture to his brother. A joint purchase of land, splitting the cost 50-50. His brother agreed, and the seed of a new chapter took root. The professor's wanderings had been a tapestry of solitude, woven through two extended journeys, one across Canada's untamed expanses, the other through Montana's rugged heart. The glacier-crowned peaks of western Montana, with their jagged rim rocks and saw-toothed terraces, captivated him. He roamed among sprawling grasslands and steaming geysers, stood awestruck before towering waterfalls and high plateaus, felt the pulse of the earth in wide gravel beds of the prairies. This was no mere landscape. It was a sanctuary, a family to replace the one he had left behind. Here, in the embrace of the forest, he found a home. The words of Henry David Thoreau, the revered naturalist and philosopher, echoed in his mind, a beacon for his solitary quest. Thoreau had written of his own retreat to nature, and I quote, "My house was on the side of a hill, immediately on the edge of the larger wood, in the midst of a young forest, of pitch, pines, and hickories, and half a dozen rods from the pond, to which a narrow footpath led down the hill. I have thus a tight shingled and plastered house, 10 feet wide by 15 long, and 8 feet posts, 2 trapdoors, 1 door at the end, and a brick fireplace opposite. I dug my cellar, in the side of a hill sloping to the south, where a woodchuck had formerly dug his burrow. Down through sumac and blackberry roots, and the lowest stain of vegetation, 6 feet square by 7 deep, to a fine sand where potatoes could not freeze in any winter. My furniture, part of which I made myself, and the rest cost me nothing, of which I have not rendered an account, consisted of a bed, a table, a desk, 3 chairs, a kettle, a skillet, 2 knives and forks, 3 plates, 1 cup, 1 spoon, and a jug for oil. End quote. Thoreau had built his cabin with felled pines, using a burrowed axe, for a mere $28.12, equivalent to roughly $1,000 today. His weekly necessities cost 27 cents, about $10 in modern terms. He described his home as airy and fragrant, a mountain retreat where moles dwelled in the cellar and a hare visited weekly, a humble abode that harmonized with the wild. Inspired by Thoreau, the man now called the Hermit first pitched a tent on a rugged plot in Baldy Mountain. On the 19th of June 1971, he and his brother purchased nearly 1.5 acres along the pitted trail to Stemple Pass, a jagged edge of the Continental Divide. A local rancher, Clifford David Gehring, sold the land for $2,100, with a single dollar down and the brother's signature as co-signer. The Hermit funded his share with savings from certificates of deposit, a small fortune for a man determined to live simply. Gehring passed away on the 1st of August 1974, laid to rest on his ranch, leaving his son Butch to manage the family sawmill. The Hermit, meanwhile, calculated he could survive on $200 a year, akin to Thoreau's frugal allowance, sustaining himself through ingenuity and the land's bounty. His plot lay near Humburg Contour Road, a glorified dirt path winding past Poor Man's Creek, a quarter mile from Gehring's Lumber Company. To the north, 5 miles away, sprawled Lincoln, Montana, a modest town of 500 souls nestled between Missoula and Great Falls. Each summer, tourists from Helena, 55 miles distant, doubled its population. Drawn to its mining and lumber heritage, Lincoln boasted a full-time doctor, a medical center, a pharmacy, and part-time specialists, a dentist, a vet, an eye doctor, and a chiropractor, a master electrician, a volunteer fire department, a sheriff's office, and a jail. Served the community alongside a newspaper, a beef jerky plant, 5 motels, 5 cafes, 2 grocery stores, 3 gas stations, 2 laundromats, a supper club, a general store, a video store, and 4 churches, a vibrant hub in the western foothills. From the ruins of an abandoned log cabin, the Hermit salvaged lumber to craft his own sanctuary. A 10-by-12-foot shack crowned with a sharp-peaked, dun-colored roof and a tin chimney. Its plywood walls, clad in green tar paper, leaned slightly, and the roof admitted trickles of rain. Like Thoreau's cabin, it featured 2 single-pane windows, each 12-by-12 inches, admitting slivers of sunlight. 1 window, set above eye level, guarded his privacy. The other allowed him to scan for intruders. By night, he read by the flicker of homemade candles, their glow illuminating a world of ideas. The cabin lacked electricity or plumbing, secured by a makeshift padlock outside and 2 deadbolts within. It was a fortress of solitude. Over time, only 2 visitors crossed its threshold. A volunteer fire lieutenant and census taker named Joe Uderian, who also worked at the beef jerky factory, he once knocked on the door. Most locals respected the Hermit's reclusiveness, leaving provisions outside, but on this day he invited Joe inside. Joe took the cabin's only chair, surveying what he later called a real bachelor pad. Clothes lay in heaps on the floor, while books, some 60 volumes, lined the walls, their titles a testament to the hermit's intellect. Thackeray, Thoreau, Shakespeare, Victor Hugo. The list went on. The hermit crouched on a thin mattress atop a wooden cot, surrounded by simple tools, a slop bucket, papers, and more books crowding a small table. Joe, struck by the contrast between the shack's simplicity and the man's erudition, engaged him in conversation. They spoke of Vietnam, then gardening, and Joe left with a newfound respect for the reclusive scholar. The cabin, though small, became a repository of the hermit's life, its contents defying Thoreau's minimalism. His tools included a hand-bowed wood saw, two spades, a welder's mask, a drill, a compass on a string, and a wood-handled hammer. Rugged implements for a rugged life. His wardrobe comprised a blue zippered sweatshirt, a blue jacket, a green hooded jacket, a rain poncho, a brown raincoat, a hat, a camouflage jacket with matching pants, a canvas jacket, a woodland green coat, mittens, a blue scarf, a turquoise and verdant scarf, a red hat, and two pairs of plastic glasses. For footwear, he owned 8 pairs of Northwest Territory hiking shoes and a pair of boots. His cooking gear included 2 steak knives, a metal pan and stick, cans with matches, 4 measuring spoons, a metal pot, 2 white mix-and-drink plastic cups, a handleless frying pan, and a wood-handled knife in a newspaper sheath. He organized his possessions in scavenged containers, a tater-tot box held books and maps, Hershey's cocoa cans stored nuts and bolts. His academic degrees rested in a Samsonite briefcase, while 39 yearbooks filled a green plastic bag. Student guides from the University of Montana and Carroll College, rolled up maps and a shopping bag containing his Montana driver's license and less than $50 in cash, completed his inventory. A radio, useless without electricity, and a map of Lincoln hinted at a world he rarely engaged. His library, eventually swelling to 233 volumes, was a vibrant mosaic of thought. Bright book jackets against dark wood, a testament to his restless mind. Among them was Paul Goodman's Growing Up Absurd, a critique of society's suppression of individuality that resonated deeply. Alongside Asimov's Guides to the Bible, a Holy Bible Dictionary, Concordance, Chemistry Texts, Electrical Circuitry Manuals, comes The Comrade, Eastern Mysticism, and 2 volumes of Les Miserables. The hermit's only other known visitor was Glenn Williams, owner of a nearby hunting cabin. Over the years they shared meals, hunted in the surrounding mountains, and the hermit occasionally did chores for Williams, forging a quiet bond. Outside his shack, the hermit stacked glass and plastic bottles, with 4 1-gallon jugs hanging from a wooden beam between aspens. Groves of ponderosa pine and lodgepoles encircled the cabin, their branches swaying in the wind. A large tree bore a ladder of 2x4s leading to a tree stand, perhaps a vantage for hunting or a lookout for solitude. A plastic bucket, likely a food cache, dangled from a limb, while others hung inexplicably. Water came from Poorman's Creek, a narrow stream just steps away, while Canyon Creek flowed behind the shack, where the hermit had built a root cellar to store potatoes, parsnips, and carrots grown in his mother's garden. The region's harsh winters, averaging minus 20 degrees Celsius in January, and short growing season, challenged his efforts, but he persevered, supplementing his diet with rabbits hunted with a 22 caliber rifle, the same caliber his terminally ill father had used to end his life. In the heart of Montana's wilderness, The hermit's life was a quiet rebellion against a world he scorned, and a need for cleansing arose. He stood beneath a 5-gallon bucket hung from a sturdy aspen limb, icy water cascading over his lean frame in a bracing ritual. The grove around his shack sang with the ceaseless wind, its rustling pines mimicking the rush of a distant river. Yet the true river, the mighty Blackfoot, Big River to locals, thundered nearby, its waters carving through the canyon above the old Clearwater Bridge, a fishing haven on Sunset Hill Road where it met Highway 200 east of Greenbow Hill. Green River's roar was a primal force, echoing the hermit's unyielding spirit. His existence revolved around two gardens, both larger than his modest shack. The smaller, a verdant patch, steps from his cabin, offered quick sustenance. The larger one, sprawling 900 square feet, was 50 feet away, and was girded by a 10-foot barbed wire fence to deter bears and deer. A hand-hewed ladder allowed him to scale the barrier, descending into his sanctuary of soil. Nearby, an open-air drying shed held game, used only in winter when insects lay dormant. Ever cautious, the hermit kept his deer-hunting license current, avoiding law enforcement's gaze. Across 147,000 square miles of Big Sky country, May and June drenched the land in rain. Summers blazed at 47 degrees Celsius, the air shimmering with heat, while winter nights plunged to a bone-chilling minus 40 degrees Celsius at the worst, winds howling like specters. Early snows cloaked the continental divide, and the hermit, tireless, felled and hauled firewood to warm his unpowered shack. Contact was rare. Family marked urgent letters with a red line below the stamp, lest they go unread or be burnt. His lofty ideals of friendship left him friendless, yet he aided neighbors, cutting lumber with astonishing vigor. Surplus vegetables, potatoes, carrots, went to a nearby couple, thus showcasing a quiet generosity. His bearded, gaunt visage, framed by a long, unkempt beard and hair, defied later rumors of army fatigues. In Lincoln, he wore tattered jeans and a clean shirt, sunglasses shielding his eyes. When removed, his piercing gaze, sharp as an X-ray, unnerved onlookers, revealing a soul both wild and profound. In the solitude of his Montana shack, the hermit poured his thoughts into a journal, striving to craft words that were robust, unyielding, and profound. He sought a testament, not born of cloistered studies or poetic retreats, but steeped in the raw essence of the mountains, fields, and forests, a prose infused with the bracing vitality of the wild. Once or twice monthly, he ventured into Lincoln, traveling on a bicycle of his own ingenious design. This one-speed marvel, with its high handlebars and 26-inch wide tires, was a triumph of function over form, its mismatched parts culled from disparate eras, defying age or convention. Gearless, it carried him along a 4-mile gravel road, through rain, snow, or searing summer light. Only deep snow prompted a concession. Chains strapped to the tires for traction. Style held no sway. He bound his pant legs tight, tucking cuffs into socks to avoid the chain's grasp, his backpack flapping like a banner as he jolted along. In storms too fierce even for his resolve, he hitched a ride with the mailman, a rare surrender to the elements. In Lincoln, the hermit frequented the modest Lincoln Community Library, a long, low building with a corrugated metal roof, redwood log posts, and painted wood siding. Inside, oak tables gleamed under soft light, and he gravitated toward non-fiction tomes, their weighty ideas to mirror his restless mind. After a brief phone call, he headed to the Blackfoot Market, where co-owner Karen Potter noted his quiet presence. Head bowed, rarely smiling, perhaps due to his worn teeth, he spoke in clipped sentences, yet his lean frame bespoke a rugged vitality. Few in Lincoln, save librarian Sherry Wood and the town's bookish circle, grasped his intellect. Butch Gearing glimpsed it when the hermit helped repair his house for Seller Wood, calculating fractions mid-hammer with startling ease, lamenting his annual costs rising from $200 to $300. Roger Holm, a neighboring cattle rancher, saw it too when the hermit entered a newspaper contest, swiftly circling 147 grammatical errors, his pen blackening the page with relentless precision, a testament to a mind as sharp as the wilderness he called home.
Hotels.com knows that planning your book club's annual field trip can get chaotic. Bria, the romance reader, wants to stay in Prince Charming's castle. Self-improvement Steve needs a hotel gym. Leela and Jeff, the horror fans, ghosted the group chat about budget. And you've read enough true crime to know that murdering them isn't a real option. With the Hotels.com app, invite all your friends to collaborate and find the perfect hotel together. Share properties, vote on your favorites, and book all in one place. Find your perfect somewhere with Hotels.com.
Is your AC struggling? Loud noises, weird smells, uneven temperatures, sky-high energy bills? It might be time for a new system. With over 25 years of experience, AirPros will get the job done right, and right now, AirPros USA can help you get that new AC installed before summer and offers financing with payments as low as $89 a month. Get your free AC installation quote today. Visit AirProsUSA.com. Don't suffer through another hot summer. Visit AirProsUSA.com.
Financing offered with approved credit. License number CAC 1822083. CFC 053314. EC 1301093.
And with that, we come to the end of part 2 in this series covering the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. Next episode, I will continue his saga. So as they say in the land of radio, stay tuned.